Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The One Up Podcast with Gary Williams is presented by Peter Millar. Wherever you go, lead a life styled with luxury apparel from Peter Millar. This week's One Up Podcast brings together two people who you would say, I don't get it. Well, Brant Snedeker is a 9-time winner on the PGA Tour. He's won the FedEx Cup title as well. And Jay Billis is somebody who's an analyst in college basketball. But they went to two of the best schools in America, Vanderbilt and Duke. They're huge sports fans. And Jay is a passionate golfer, plays a tremendous amount of golf. And both of them have some things in their background that are very similar to one another, as you're going to find out. So for Brant Snedeker, who is a guy who's been a multiple-time President's Cup and Ryder Cup member from the United States, and for Jay Billis, who had a very good career at Duke University and really started what Duke is now under Mike Krzyzewski back in the early 80s, is now the preeminent college basketball analyst in the world. So here's my conversation with Brant Snedeker and Jay Billis. On Wikipedia, I don't know how often you ever go to your own page, but Brant, your Wikipedia page starts by saying he's an American professional golfer who plays on the PGA Tour. And Jay, yours says, is an American college basketball analyst for ESPN, a former NCAA announcer for CBS Sports, and also a former college basketball player. Brant, doesn't it sound like they're trying to force Jay as being more credible by having to say all that stuff in the first sentence as opposed to you, which is pretty simple?
Yeah, you know, I never really thought about it. I mean, I guess they're trying to validate Jay's career in some way, shape, or form. It seems to me as a lot of ex-professions, not really a current profession.
If I Googled myself as much as you guys, perhaps I could manage this a little bit better. But, I think it should lead with me. It should say golfer that won the third flight and a member guest one year. You know, you're Snedeker's leading with this 2012. He's still living off the 2012 FedEx Cup, man. I've moved on.
I did win and shoot 59 last year on PGA Tour. So, I have moved on.
he did indeed do that. You know, you two have been around each other a little bit, and I think you've played a couple holes together at minimum at Bill Haas's charity event several years ago. But I don't think have the two of you played a round of golf together?
We have not.
Not a full round, no. Yeah, we just played that one time at Haas's event at the Chanticleer.
Okay, Brant, do you remember Jay's golf swing?
No, I can't say. You know, it's funny. It's not really memorable, to be honest with you. You'd think somebody as tall as Jay would have this great golf swing to look at. Professional athlete, so normally pretty good. But I don't remember it being anything special, to say the least.
Jay, do you want to analyze Brant's golf swing?
I remember that a little bit differently, Gary. That I remember Brant standing behind taking notes in his little notebook. He didn't take any video, which he probably should have, but he was clearly taking notes.
Well, he does
love
analytics.
That's probably what led to the 59, honestly.
Were there lots of high cuts? I distinctly remember a lot of high cuts maybe involved in Jay swings.
There were a lot of people yelling, "Four right."
I kind of remember that maybe.
You know, you two, the way that I look at it, and I've spent more time around Jay than I have Brant around you, but it's interesting. You have a number of things in common, and really the way that I try to look at putting people together on this podcast is they may have a lot in common, a little in common, but they have a golf in common. And you do have golf in common. Now, Brant, you play it obviously professional. Jay, you love it, and you play truly from the day after the national championship until you work through the summer at various camps. You have your own camp in Charlotte and make contributions to the game of basketball, but you play a lot of golf. But you have other things in common. You have older brothers, both of you, who are very good at golf. And Brant, your dad is a lawyer, your brother is a judge,
And Jay, you still have a license, and you were a practicing attorney for a really fine firm in Charlotte, Moore Van Allen. And I also think you both love to win the argument. You both like to make your point to the point that other people go, "Yep, you're right. I'll accept your position." Is that fair?
I would say.
Yeah, I think it's fair.
That's pretty fair. I mean, I think I like to argue. I mean, I come from an arguing family. I have a dad who's an attorney who was never wrong, a brother who's a judge who's definitely legally never wrong, and then you put me in there, who's a professional golfer who's been kind of babied my whole life and told how great I am. So you get us three in a room, there's a lot of arguing going on, a lot of trying to prove each other right or wrong. And so, yeah, I'd say that's pretty accurate.
Jay did
One of the things about arguing is people seem to get a misconception about that. They somehow think that if you argue, you're just, you know, you think you're always right. And I think when you argue or debate something, you're trying to find the right answer and test your position. So one of the ways where things that I feel passionate about, I want to discuss them because people with other views sort of stress test my views. And you wind up coming to the right place, at least for the right answer. And so it's not always about trying to prove you're right as much as it is stress test your judgment.
You know, Jay, when you were growing up, your brother Dave is considerably older than you. It's 7.5, 8 years. Is that about right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
okay.
7 years. Yep.
Okay. Now, you know, you are, you know, physically, he's not nearly as tall as you are. It appeared that you were, you know, pretty destined to make basketball your pursuit at a fairly young age. And I know you didn't play a lot of golf as a kid, but your brother did. Brent, I don't know if you know this, but his brother Dave used to knock heads with Mark O'Meara and John Cook in Southern California, literally right in their own area right there, and held his own. Jada, did your brother being good at golf make you interested in golf? Or what was your take on your brother playing the game at a high level while you were doing something else?
Well, my brother was my idol growing up, that he was good at everything. He was a great baseball player. He was a very good basketball player, even though he was only, you know, 6'2". So when I was a kid, he was in high school, and you know, he was one of the best athletes at our high school. We had a really big high school. But golf was his best sport, and he was he's a junior champion. Did very, very well, and he and John Cook used to play one another every year in the club championship where our fathers were members, and you know, they were teenagers winning that thing every year. And so, but I did not take to golf. My dad played and joined a club so my brother could play, and then he tried to get me to. But for some reason, when I was a kid, golf was everything I didn't want any part of. It was, you know, be quiet, don't do this, you're violating this rule, my goodness, how could you make that noise while somebody else was doing it? And there were too many rules, and I just wasn't interested, and I turned away from it. And I really didn't get into it until after I got out of college and I was playing professional basketball overseas. It was something that I did with my friends in between workouts during the summertime, and I got hooked on it. To the point where I wanted to play every day, and I got horribly upset if I lost a golf ball, and to the point where I wouldn't even hit a driver. I used to hit a 2-iron off the tee because I could control it better than a driver, and I just couldn't get enough of it.
You didn't really control it a lot better than a driver because I was a witness to it.
I did.
No, you didn't.
I used to crush that 2-iron.
Well, you did, but it was so... It was so imbecilic that you thought that it was easier to hit a 2-iron. He thought it was easier to hit 2-iron than figure out a way to hit a driver. And he did this truly for like 2 years, which is crazy, isn't it?
What kind of 2-iron was it? I know you know it. You got to remember it.
I don't. You know what?
Yeah,
it's a great question.
I had a TaylorMade set, and I hit a 2-iron, and I could hit it a good. I don't know, Gary. You were there a lot. I could hit it a good 240 off the tee.
Yeah, I was going to say 240, 245.
I was pretty happy with that, but I could control it better because every once in a while, you know, I'd pull that driver out and I'd blow one out of bounds and lose a bet, and it just crushed me. And actually, I wound up kind of committing to the driver when Danny Ferry, who's a close friend of mine, we were playing one day, and he asked me to see my 2-iron on the first tee, and he took it and threw it over the fence and said, commit to the driver right now. And that's when I kind of committed to the driver.
You didn't listen to me for 2 years, but you listened to him. Brent, your brother...
I didn't have a choice. He threw my 2-iron away.
How about your brother, Hames, who is a very fine player and has pursued, you know, his competitive golf at the mid-AM level? Did he motivate you to get better? Because he's, I believe, 4 years older than you.
Yeah, he did. You know, it's very eerily similar story to Jay there. My brother was a really good athlete, played basketball, was kind of good at everything he did, and just kind of took to golf later than me. You know, I started golf when I was probably 6, 7 years old. He started at the same time when he was probably 12, 13. But he kind of played everything, and golf is kind of what he did during the summertime, and ended up playing college golf at Ole Miss and kind of had a passion for it and loved it. And so, you know, you can imagine our matches on the weekend, I'm battling, just trying to, you know, being 5 years behind him in school. I obviously didn't hit as far as he did, just trying to keep up with him and try to beat him. And it took me a long time to do that. I remember the first time I beat him, I was a senior in high school, and he was a senior in college. And we played a tournament in the summertime called the Municipal Amateur. It's a city championship, and he had won it 4 years in a row, coming off a great senior year at Ole Miss, where he was a first-team All-American and all that kind of stuff. And I was going to Vanderbilt, and the first time I beat him, I shot 66 on the last round. He shot 70, and I beat him by 2 shots. And I still say it's the last time he even got close to beating me. But he, you know, it was great for me to kind of have him as a sounding board, have him as a kind of a benchmark of how to get my game better, how to compete and play golf better in college and then on in the professional rank. And he's probably could have played professionally if he wanted to. He just never had that desire. He didn't like traveling all the time and being on the road and all the things that would go into it. So he kind of went into law, became an attorney, a real estate developer, and now a judge down in Southern Alabama. And so we still play when we get together, and he still loves it. I mean, he probably can't play as much as he should, but you know, one out of every 3 or 4 times we're playing, it gets pretty close down the last hole or two, and I end up having to do something pretty special to beat him, but I still can't let him beat me now.
You know, Jay, I know you play a lot of golf with your brother Dave still. It's one of the great joys, and I know that you did a little Q&A with the USGA when they had the Mid-Am, a club that you're a member at, a terrific club, Charlotte Country Club, and you said your dream foursome would be you, your brother, your father, and Tiger Woods. Why is it so enjoyable to play golf with Dave?
Well, one, he's really easygoing, and you know, similar to what Brant's talking about. I mean, my brother never really gets mad on a golf course, and part of it, I think, part of it's his personality, that he's just a really good guy, and the other part of it is he knows how to play, and so if he does something, you know, that would make me mad, he knows A, he can get out of it, and B, he's not going to do it again. And you know, when I get upset that when I do something, you know, stupid on a golf course or hit a bad shot or something, I'm worried about doing it again, and it's probably why I get upset. But he's really fun to be around. And when you play with someone who like my brother, who is so talented, it's a joy to watch. You know, like when you get to play with a guy like Brandt or you, or guys that really know how to play. Like, I still talk about, Gary, that flop shot you hit on 18 over the bunker at Pinehurst number 2.
It's so kind
of when you got up and down from jail over there is one of the greatest things I've ever seen. I mean, it's just so much fun to play with guys that know how to play, and that's one of the reasons I love golf.
You know, Brant, one of the first rounds I played with Jay and Dave is old school, and we were playing at TPC Piper Glen, and it was about 107 degrees, and I pull up, and Dave is dressed in all black from head to toe, slacks. I mean, he looks like Gary Player getting ready for the final round of the 59 Open Championship, and I looked at Jay, and I went, is this for real? Dave, I mean, is that fair to say, Jay? I mean, he is old school.
Yeah, he's old school. He doesn't, similar to what Brant was talking about with his brother, I think my brother could have played on the tour, but he just didn't like to practice. He liked to play. And so, you know, even when we go out and play now, it doesn't matter. He'll go out and he'll hit balls for a couple minutes just to get warmed up, and then he's had enough. He wants to go play. And he'll play all day long, and he lives it. He loves it, absolutely loves it. But he does not enjoy that, and the fact that putting is not his thing. Like he can go out and shoot 67 tomorrow. Maybe not now because we're so much older. But I've seen him do this where he'll shoot 4 or 5 under, and he doesn't have many putts outside of 5 feet. He could hit the ball so close for so many years. It just putting was never his thing.
You know, both of you guys have had great achievement in your various sports. And Brent, you know the term scar tissue. It's one that I don't think you hear much in other sports because most of the other sports, you know, you share the collective achievement or the loss together. Whereas with you guys, like, well, you know, he's got the scar tissue from blowing that four-shot lead. The 2008 Masters, you're right there. You're two back of Immelman going into the final round. You didn't win. Obviously, he won. And Jay, the 86 National Championship game against Louisville, you were part of one of the greatest teams in college basketball history, but you didn't win the last game. What do you think, Brent, is the difference between having to deal with loss as an individual as opposed to Jay, who can share it or lament it with guys like Johnny Dawkins and David Henderson and Mark Allery and guys who were part of that great Duke team? How do you deal with loss when it was only you?
Yeah, you know, I think it's in some ways it's easier, in some ways it's harder. You know, in some ways it's definitely easier because being on some Ryder Cup teams and President's Cup teams, the worst feeling in golf is losing for your teammates, is doing something where you feel like you didn't hold up your end of the bargain. You know, we didn't win in 2012. I was on a team in Chicago, and I still feel guilty to Davis Love to this day. He gets blamed for this, you know, epic comeback. We won one of the worst losses in Ryder Cup history, and Davis didn't have anything to do with it. You know, it was nothing he could have done any differently that would have changed that day. We just didn't play good. We as players messed it up, and it's one of the worst feelings I've ever had in golf. Going back to the Masters in 2008, it was an awful feeling, but you also learn from it, and you kind of wake up the next day and go, okay, this is what I think I did wrong. This is where the pressure got to me. This is what I need to work on next time I get in the situation. And you kind of – that one stung for a while because I was a young kid. I didn't really know what I was doing at that time and had a really good chance and kind of blew it. But that's part of golf. You know, I fail all the time. You know, I've probably played 250 events in my career, and I've won 9 of them. So I got a pretty high failure rate. So failure is something you have to be okay with in golf, and if you're not okay with it, then you're going to struggle because you're going to fail a lot out here. You kind of have to have a method for how you kind of cope with it and look at it objectively, take yourself out of it. You know, I got a great comment from Phil one time. I asked him how he dealt with it all the time. You know, him being under the microscope that he is, all that kind of stuff that goes into it. All the times he's lost, all the times he's won. He said, you know, I have to kind of separate Phil Mickelson, the player, from Phil Mickelson, the person, because they're two totally different people. You know, Phil Mickelson, the golfer, who gets criticized all the time for whatever reason, for losing a golf tournament, losing a, you know, doing something or whatever it may be. I have to separate that person completely from who I am as a person. You know, Phil Mickelson, the father, Phil Mickelson, the husband, everything I do all outside of that. When people attack me or say, you know, I get barbecued in the press, whatever it might be, they're not attacking me as a human being. They're attacking me as a golfer. And so I've got to be able to separate those two. And he's going to really help me kind of deal with that in my career. And I'll be able to bounce back a lot faster. And so I kind of took that to heart when I talked to him. I was like, it made a lot of sense. You know, I've got to be able to separate that and not view all this negative stuff that's going to come out when you do fail as this attack on me personally. It's just my profession. It's what I do. I care about it a ton. But, you know, you got to be able to separate those two from your life. Otherwise, they'll just eat you up. And so I'm still learning how to deal with failure. You know, I still deal with it all the time, obviously, out here. But, you know, you got to have a process to kind of get yourself out of it, find the positives in the bad situation and move on. But, you know, comparing it with teammates, the worst loss I've ever had is that Ryder Cup that we lost when we were up by 4.5 points. The worst I've ever felt after any tournament ever because I let my teammates down and I let my coach down, Davis, captain that year. And you feel like you let the country down. It's just like the three things on top of each other. So I don't know how. You know, if I did that all the time, it'd be really, really tough to deal with that, I think.
Jay, does it help that you can that you and these teammates that are like brothers to you to this day, or is there some pain that is associated with because you look at them and go, God, I wish I could have done more. I know how that lives inside you, that damn game.
Yeah, the pain of losing something that you work for and that you value never goes away. It may get you learn how to deal with it better, but that never goes away. And I think Brandt nailed it. And I think maybe some people might not get exactly the context of what's being discussed is that when Brandt refers to failure and failure is something that athletes deal with every single day, it's failure to reach the stated goal. So if the stated goal is a championship, then anything short of that is a failure. But most people don't look at it that way. They don't look at, well, wait a minute, you were in the last group of the Masters. That's not a failure. That's an extraordinary achievement. But that wasn't necessarily the ultimate objective there. So when you talk about failure, it's like the best athletes and the ones who are the most secure in what they do, and this probably goes to anything, really, now we're talking about in the context of athletics, but are the ones who accept the consequences that come with failure. And so if you're gonna compete and put yourself out there, you're gonna fail. You're gonna fail to win this day. You're gonna fail to shoot the score you have to. You're gonna fail to win this game, whatever it is. That's gonna happen. But you have to both mentally and emotionally be willing to accept what comes with that. Otherwise, you wouldn't be able to draw the club back. If you're trying to hit a shot, you have to be willing to accept what comes with missing that shot. Otherwise, you're not going to be able to execute it. And that may be a distinction without a difference to some people, but most people will look at Brandt and say, my God, you played in the Masters. That's not a failure not to win the Masters. But when the ultimate objective of Brandt's is to win it, then you do look at that as a failure, and you have to accept that, and that's not always easy to do.
You know, Brandt, Jay and I went to the 2008 Ryder Cup in Louisville because his brother lived in Louisville. And so I think I saw, Jay, what did I see, two shots over the course of the competition? Because, you know, I'm barely 5'9", and he's 6'8", and he took great pleasure in the fact that it looked like he was walking around with his son and that I should be on his shoulders. Brent, I want you to listen to Jay's thoughts about, like, because Jay and I, after you guys lost in 2012, had multiple conversations. Jay, I don't know if you remember it. And it was always, Brent, it's always, well, they just made more putts. See, I think there's something deeper to you know, the cultures of the European Tour, and we don't have enough time to go into my thesis on it. But Jay, you are somebody who watched what happened to USA basketball and the deconstruction of the international teams under the direction of your former college coach, and what has happened since. And I happen to believe it can be done with USA golf to some degree. Jay, what are your thoughts about the United States and the culture of the golf, trying to do something where there are individuals 51 weeks out of the year, and then they're trying to be a team, but having roots that allow you to have a system like a USA basketball?
I think that's the analog. I think USA basketball is the analog because if you guys remember, if you go back in sort of international basketball over the years, the United States had fallen behind, where it had been the dominant entity internationally, had fallen behind, and we were losing at every level. And so we're not winning gold medals as we did before. It wasn't just the margins, but the narrative was, well, the rest of the world has caught up. And I remember thinking, well, that's not true. We just don't have the proper program in place that's going to make this a priority. And I realize basketball and golf are very, very different. I'm not trying to analogize the two sports, but the two programs. I think the Ryder Cup process is very similar to what USA Basketball used to do, and which was just a couple months in advance, pick out a team, and then try to make it into a team in a very short period of time. And we've got a program now where the team is together, and you have a pool of players that's together. And they get together and they play, and they have the team in place whether somebody qualifies for it or not. You're still in the pool, and so if I were in charge of golf, I would have Jerry Colangelo and Greg Popovich and Coach K and all these people sitting in my office, or I'd go to see them and say, how do we duplicate what you've done from a programmatic standpoint? Because when you lose one Ryder Cup, it may be putting, it may be the course set, there may be reasons behind it. When you lose 6 of 8, that's a trend. And I don't think our talent level would speak to losing 6 of 8. Or whatever the number is. I think it might be that, but whatever the number is, it's a trend and a negative one that I think programmatically could be fixed by the way we go about it.
Brent, what do you think do you think that the way that things were kind of examined after 2014, that you guys do have a blueprint that long-term is going to be effective and successful?
I do, yeah. I mean, after being on a team in 2012 and then on 16, I kind of saw the difference in where it was going. I think what Jay's talking about is there's a lot of merit to that, and that having that group of that pool of players together more than just the month leading up to the tournament. You know, there's got to be some, you know, trust level. I will say on both teams I was on, the team room was unbelievable. You know, I felt like the teams were really super close. There was no dysfunction at all. There was no kind of drama or anything like that. I felt like the teams were, Davis did a great job on both those teams of kind of getting the teams together. You know, I think what we have in place now is we have an outline of how to go about, you know, dealing with all the stuff that happens with a Ryder Cup. You know, the hardest thing that we had before was you get a captain and say, here you go, you got 2 years to figure this out, have at it. No blueprint, no like, hey, this is what we've done in years past, here's how we kind of go through it. We're going to have some assistant captains that have been around or that are past captains. They can kind of help you through the process where they thought there were some holes or where they thought they really struggled. And now we've got that in place where all these guys are being named captains now, have been assistant captains, have been around it. They're going to have former captains as their assistants to help them through this whole process so they can really focus on what's important, which is building a great team. You know, having those guys show up on the same page, ready to go, and excited about it. You know, and I feel like, you know, last year, I'm writing off last year's as an anomaly more than the rule because it's under the new process, but the process is great. I thought the golf course setup was so extreme that it was built completely to where U.S. had a very low chance of being successful because of the way they set the golf course up with extremely tight fairways, extremely thick rough. They kind of used our biggest assets, which was our length, the way guys were able to overpower golf courses and turn it against us. And we weren't able to kind of overcome. And then you get on slow greens like that they have over there in Europe, and they did everything that we did in 2016 when we won. Set the golf course up to the strength of the team so that whatever little bit of advantage you can get, we had. In 16, the golf course was set up with very little rough, long, wide-open fairways. Greens were relatively receptive but fast. So pins were relatively easy, so we made a lot of birdies. We got the crowd into it early. People started getting raucous, and it was unbelievable home court advantage. Well, they kind of flipped the script on us and did the exact same thing in Europe. So there's a lot to that. I think now with the process in place that we have a way better chance of being successful because these captains are in a way better situation for the team to be great leaders, to give these guys all the assets they need to be successful. But there definitely needs to be what Jay's talking about is that pool of players needs to get together. I think it's would be a great piece of advice for our team is to get them together two or three times a year so they start developing those friendships, that trust, playing practice rounds together, that kind of thing, so guys kind of know what they're getting themselves into. Because you get thrown into a Ryder Cup, it's one of the most high-stress, high-pressure situations you're ever going to be in, way more so than a major, way more so than any tour event. That first tee to Ryder Cup makes you want to vomit. You're so nervous. And so if you don't have trust in that person next to you and know what's going to happen and have that confidence built up, it can be really, really tough on two new guys who hadn't played a lot of golf together, we get thrown in that kind of fire. So you've got to have those trusts built up, and then you know what Jay's talking about would be a great way to start doing that.
Coincidentally, and Jay knows this, and Brent, I'm sure you do too, Coach K is not a golfer, but if I'm not mistaken, I think he went to a dinner last fall at the BMW prior to the Ryder Cup in Philadelphia. And was with the guy. Were you at that? The team was set already, so I don't think you were at that dinner. Okay,
I wasn't at the dinner. No, yeah. But yes, I did. I did hear about that. He was there. Yes.
Yeah. You know, Jay, when you said it's, you know, you don't want to be, you're not trying to analogize one sport to the other. But what do you think is the most transferable thing that can be applied to what USA Basketball did to the Ryder Cup culture in the United States? What is the most important thing they need to achieve? That they can.
Well, one, and I think this is what one of the things Coach K addressed. I mean, one is a togetherness thing that you can't really duplicate unless you've been together and you have that, you know, sort of collective vision of what you're trying to do. That the Ryder Cup, the USA Basketball, you know, the Olympic team, those are not all-star teams. They're USA teams, and it's something that's a lot bigger than any individual. And I think everybody has to be willing to play a role that is less than they feel like maybe they would want. And they have to be willing to embrace that. I'm willing to do anything for us. And, you know, we over me, but not exclusive of me, because there are a lot of good me's in that room. Like Coach K always used to say that when he was with the Olympic team, he would tell them, look, I don't want any of you guys leaving, checking your ego at the door. Bring your egos with you. I mean, there are amazing egos in this room. but you want your egos to blend together to have the best possible team and the best outcome. And you know, playing for the United States is a different feeling. Like I did it. I played USA basketball, not on the Olympic level, but there's not been anything in my life that's been anything like putting on a USA basketball jersey. Not anything. And as great as everything has always felt, everything else I did, nothing felt quite like that. And I think that's a feeling you have to share and get used to and embrace, rather than you know, going into it and walking out of it. And there's so much said. The Ryder Cup, I think, is unique. There's so much said going into it, and then there's so much criticism if you don't win, that it's easy to fracture. And then you have some people who say things they shouldn't afterwards, and it reflects badly on everyone else. I mean, it really has to be a we first endeavor, and that's not something you can get from just picking an all-star team and going. Not to say that's all that the Ryder Cup is about. I'm not suggesting that, but there has to be a higher calling, if you will, and more attention paid to the we part of it beforehand, before getting there.
Brent, last fall in Paris, the first match that Rory McIlroy played, he was paired with Torbjørn Olesen. And I looked at it and I thought to myself, you know what? It just anybody, doesn't matter, whatever you tell me, whomever you tell me to play for. And I have the feeling that if let's say Tiger or Phil, if either one of them was paired with somebody whose profile was so low, I'd be like, well, that guy's not good enough to play with him. Is that, am I reaching too much? I just feel like they are like, whatever you tell me to do, I'm going to do. And with us, it's almost like there's criteria that needs to be met, that this guy has to have a certain profile in order to meet the standards by which, and again, Phil and Tiger are at a level nobody on the European side is, but Rory is the guy on their side, and he played with Torbjørn Olesen on Friday morning. That meant something to me.
Yeah, you know, I think the biggest thing that the captains are trying to do now with these guys is get them comfortable, because it is the most uncomfortable feeling in the world to be on that first tee. And so I don't know how the Europe team goes about it. I've talked to them numerous times, all my buddies on those teams, and find out what they do. And they just have this difference of lifestyle in Europe versus America, right? And the American tour is more kind of a lone wolf mentality. You have your swing coaches, you've got your own team, you're traveling. You know, it's so easy the tour is so easy here in America, the way we play, the way we're taken care of, the way we were able to spend time with our family and everything. It's just not, there's not a whole lot of camaraderie built. Whereas you're not traveling together a lot, you're really not doing a whole lot of that kind of stuff. Where in Europe, it's kind of innately, they have to do that. You're going through customs checks every week, going to stay, everybody staying at the same hotel because you're kind of out in the middle of nowhere, somewhere in Europe or wherever it might be, taking shuttles to and from the golf course. So you're spending a lot more time together. You know, I tell this all the time. You know, during my best friends on tour, I might see them, if we don't play together, I might see them for 2-3 hours in a total tournament week. Maybe, you know, that'd be on the high end. In a Ryder Cup situation, you are around each other 16 hours a day, every day, all day long. And so, you know, it's just building those relationships has got, you know, when we played great in 16, it was a we versus me, you know, it was a 12 strong. Everybody had to be okay with their role. I mean, I remember everybody in that team sitting there on Wednesday night telling Captain Love, or Thursday night, saying, hey, if you need me to play 5 matches, I'm in. If you need me to play 1 match, I'm in. We don't care. We just want to win. And you figure out how to put us in a situation where we can be successful in 1. And I think it's part of the reason why we were so successful that year. We just didn't – there was no egos in that room. There was not – I mean, everybody had egos on the golf course when we got out there to get the crowd going, but it was – we'll do whatever it takes. We're tired of losing. We have the home course advantage. We have the home crowd advantage. We want to be successful, you know. And so I think – comfort is a huge deal in those rooms, and having somebody playing with this comfort, you know, I guess Europe has that innate ability because they play so much more golf together over there than we do over here. So it's a lot easier for them to kind of interchange guys and pop them around to whoever. With us, I guess it's just a little bit more complicated.
You two went to two of the finest schools in America. Brand, you went to Vanderbilt, and Jay, everybody knows you went to Duke. Now, Duke and Vandy have a modest history in basketball all time since 1950. Vandy is 5-8 versus Duke. Now, the last time they beat Duke was December 11th, 1982. Jay, you were on that team.
I was a freshman.
Yeah, you were a freshman.
I was a freshman.
Yeah, and it was at Memorial Gymnasium in Nashville. What do you remember about that night? Brant, by the way, was 1 year old.
And Phil Cox, they were really good. CM Newton was coaching the team then.
Yeah. Now, Brant was 1 year old, so he wasn't there. It was 74-65. Do you remember anything about that game, Jay?
Yeah, I do. We were freshmen, so we had the number one recruiting class in the country and didn't realize, like, man, how good you had to be and together you had to be to win in tough environments. And I do remember one of our players wore a bow tie to the game. You know, we had to wear a coat and tie back then to every game. And he wore a bow tie. And after we got beat, you know, Coach K went off on this player in the locker room after the game for wearing a bow tie. And I was like, geez, I didn't know bow ties had that much of an effect on the outcome. He was really upset about the whole bow tie thing. But you know, it was just one of these deals where, like Brant was talking before about failure, you know, you go into one of those games and playing on the road is a lot harder than playing at home. And you know, we had to get used to, you know, accepting the consequences that came with missing or with losing. And at that time, I don't think we were very good at that. And we got better at it over time and became a really good team. But that was one of the road experiences from early on. You know, that was even before the holiday break my freshman year. And you know, we learned the hard way how tough you had to be in order to win on the road.
You know, Jay, your book, your New York Times bestselling book, Toughness, deals with a lot of stuff. And one of the things that you see with the kids that you're covering who are, you know, many of them don't even get to the age of 21 if they're really good. They're leaving for the NBA after a year. And pressure, particularly now with social media, and both of you are participants in it, and the impact on performance, I think that it's fascinating to watch it, whereas Jay, when you were playing, you'd be like, well, I might get lit up in the morning paper, in the Durham paper or the Raleigh paper tomorrow morning, but not in real time. As young student athletes and, you know, young professional athletes are dealing with. And Brant, when you shot 59, you shot in the first round, and you felt like if you didn't win the golf tournament, you talked about failure, you would have been ticked off, and you were actually, I think you got upset because somebody told you that CT Pan had hit his tee shot out of bounds, who was the guy who was putting pressure on you late in that tournament at the Wyndham, and because you were in your bubble, pressure. And its impact on performance, Jay, it's something I know that was something you talked about in the book, Toughness. How much harder is it now than it was 10 years ago with social media being so prolific, Jay?
It's way harder because players now, whether they be golfers or basketball players, football players, whatever, they're carrying more baggage from social media with them. And that's a question of sort of the consequences part we were talking about before, that now you're worried about what are people saying. And I know there are players that check their phones at halftime. And I know officials do it. They're checking their phones at halftime. And what's being said? Broadcasters do it. I don't. And I think being older for me is really helpful because I lived in a world where what people thought didn't matter what somebody wrote on a bathroom wall or something. Cause I always called Twitter and then I, you know, now Instagram, all these other things, Snapchat, I called them one big bathroom wall. Now that doesn't mean that you can't have beautiful prose and something wonderful written on the bathroom wall, but a lot of stuff you don't need to see. And so managing that is really, really difficult for a lot of these, especially young players. You know, one thing said about them that's good, they dismiss. But one thing said about them that's bad, they carry with them for a long, long time. And you know, that's one of the reasons, Gary, that golf has been so helpful to me. And I wish I had played when I was younger because I think golf is really good at training a person that you have to move on from what just happened. And, you know, Coach K calls it next play mentality in basketball. I think in golf, you know, you'd say next shot. That if you're gonna carry what just happened with you, you are not going to perform well on your next shot. And you're not gonna have sort of the mental framework you need to positively act And I think that's true really in any sport, but it's more true in golf where you have more time to think. And you know, you can screw yourself up pretty well by thinking too much and letting the wrong thoughts into your memory bank.
Brand, how about you? Are you less engaged with social media, and how have you tried to find the right equilibrium to be participating but not to be affected by it?
Yeah, you know, I think part of it's just growing up without it. So I've kind of learned, seen both sides of it, right? I didn't have it in college. I didn't have it when I first got out here on tour. Now it's become part of everything we do out here. I mean, a large portion of how we interact with our fans is through social media, is through Twitter, is through Instagram, Facebook, whatever it may be. So, you know, I'm actively involved in it because I want to keep up with my fans. I choose to not read the comments. I choose not to go down that deep, dark hole of what people say or write about me. I mean, you can get stuck. You can go down a deep, dark hole. I know what's happening out here, guys, when guys start struggling and they start looking on Instagram or Twitter what people are saying about them, and it kind of cycles out of control, right? I mean, they kind of start believing what all these negative things are being written about them. You know, I kind of look at it, the stuff that's being written on there, these people don't know. They're not out here every day. They don't see the work you're putting in and what's going on and how close it might be or how hard you're working or whatever it may be. So there's about five or six people that I really care about their opinion in my life, to be honest with you, you know, about what's going on professionally, personally, whatever it is. And when I have an issue or something comes up and I'm up, you know, I fail or I've got a lot of pressure, I reach out to them and try to have them help me through whatever might be going on. And then not really pay too much attention to what's being said on social media. You know, I just don't think it's, I guess I'm lucky. I'm kind of oblivious to it all, I guess, to say the least. When somebody says something negative or writes something negative, I get it all the time, especially now with gambling being legalized. You know, people gamble $100 on you every week. I get people text me on Twitter all the time, "Way to go, stupid bum. I thought you were going to play great at Pebble this year, and you did, and you cost me $100. I'm like, what? You know, if you want to go down that road, it's just going to be so negative. I mean, it's just going to be so anti what golf, good golf looks like, which is, you know, positivity, everything, you know, waiting for that good break to happen, waiting for that good, you know, that great swing shot to change everything. And so I just try to stay away from it for the most part. But it's getting tougher. You know, the hardest thing right now that I worry about is for my kids is trying to make sure that I equip them with enough, enough things in their life that they can look at and not be overwhelmed by it, because it can be very overwhelming if you go down these dark holes, you know, and trying to make sure that they have the ability to kind of sift through it all, understand what the reality of the situation really is, and not get caught up in what really doesn't amount to a whole lot. You know, the stuff out there that's being written on social media or whatever it may be is not coming from the people that know, for the most part, what's really going on. And so you're going to have to kind of block it out and move on.
All right, I've got to ask you both about somebody that I work with, because, Jay, not only do you play a lot of golf, you watch golf, and you and I have had some conversations about some of the analysis and the opinions of Brandel Chamblee. And Brand, as a player, you know, this gets back to, you know, what you hear and dealing with analysis, whether it be constructive or something that might be biting. I think, Jay, that you and Brandel are the two best at what you do in sports. And sometimes that's not easy for the people to have to digest it, particularly when it's pointed at them. Brand, your perspective on Brandel, then I want to get Jay's.
Yeah, I think Brandel is great at what he does. He is extremely intelligent. He does a lot of homework. He reads a ton of books. You know, he's very, very smart. So when he makes an opinion, he comes from a place of intelligence. He's done his homework. He kind of helps that to form his opinion, and then he does what he's supposed to do. He forms an opinion and makes you make a decision whether A, you like it, or B, you don't like it. You know, I think great analysts, and this goes with every sport that I watch on TV, they make you make an opinion about themselves in a positive way or a negative way. They're not just making you feel, oh, well, I don't really know. Tony Romo or Jay Billis, for another great example, they make you make an opinion because they're saying, hey, this is what I'm seeing. This is what my eyes are telling me after being a player. Now as an analyst, I'm telling you this is what's going on, and I'm not afraid to say it, and I'm going to back it up with whatever stats or data or whatever else I can show to prove my point. You might not like it, and it might be a tough opinion to have, but this is where I'm coming from. This is what I'm getting paid to do, is to make an opinion. And so I've always respected Brando a lot. Now, I don't like a lot of stuff he says, and I disagree with it, but he's coming from a place of, I'm doing a lot of research, I'm working on it, and I'm coming from a player background, so I'm going to have an opinion. So I felt the same way about Johnny Miller. Johnny Miller just retired a few weeks ago, and I love listening to Johnny talk golf because he made you make an opinion about himself. You know, he made you kind of, A, get inside the player's head, B, kind of tell you what they're thinking about, but C, he kind of pushed you over the edge of either you love Johnny or you hate Johnny. There's nowhere in the middle, which is, I think, is that job. And so it's not a job. It's not a very easy job to have because you've got to be okay with making people hate you, you know, and that's part of the gig, you know? And so if you want to be great at it.
Jay, what are your thoughts about Brandel?
I think Brandel's, if not the best, one of the best in the business, because for all the things that Brandon said, he makes reasoned judgments about things. And I think people sometimes get hung up on things that he may opine on or judge as on the negative side, when the overwhelming majority of what he talks about is positive. He is just as quick to praise as he is to criticize. And, you know, Gary, you and I have talked about this a lot in our friendship and our careers, that, you know, I'm not immune to criticism in my job, but at the same time, you know, I always have had this thing that if I'm willing to accept praise, I got to be willing to accept criticism, because they're essentially one and the same. And so if I think somebody's qualified to give me a compliment, then they're qualified to tell me what they think that's on the negative side too. And I think that goes for any athlete or coach or the like, any fan that's watching, that you know, if I'm calling a game, I called Duke Carolina the other night, and if I'm calling the game, I say what I see. And if somebody doesn't like it, they are free to express their opinion, not only on my thoughts, but on me. And that's fine. You know, I think to Brant's point, that if Brandel says something that a player doesn't agree with, you know, what I would always counsel is respond. Not only respond on a reasonable basis in private, but respond in public. That's the as we started this by talking about, you know, debate. I mean, we were making some jokes about it, but, you know, we're not talking about you know, nuclear proliferation here or the SALT treaty or something. And we're talking about golf and basketball, so we can differ on these subjects and get to the right result at the end. The only thing I would push back on for anybody is the idea that somebody like Brandel or me or Johnny Miller shouldn't say something, because we're not cheerleaders. We're just giving our opinion, and there are a whole bunch of other voices out there, and they should do exactly the same thing. It's only a question of if we're right and we're reasonable. As long as you walk that line, I think everything's fair game.
All right, guys, we're going to end it. We call it the press, and actually it applies to both of your sports, one being a bet, the other being what you do when you're obviously trying to maybe create turnovers. But this is five quick questions. We'll end it with this. Now, Brant, from what I understand, you have a pretty good understanding of what people have made in their careers, and you're very buttoned up financially. You know, you won the FedEx Cup and you kept driving the same car that you had before you won all that money.
But I always say I love playing guys out here on tour who have big mortgages. I know eventually those putts will mean a lot more to them than they will to me.
Okay, well, something that we do on Morning Drive on the weekends now is I'll say, what's his number? And they have to guess what somebody's career earnings are. And I think most people, because on golf on television, they don't talk about money anymore. It's really interesting, but I think you might be good at this. So yours are going to be primarily around career earnings. So if I said to you, Luke Donald, how much is Luke? First question, Luke Donald, how much money has he made in his career? Official.
$38 million.
Okay, it's $35.9 million. I picked him because he's right in front of you.
Okay.
You're 23rd all time on the money list. He's 22nd. How about Davis Love III?
$58 million.
$44.9 million. He's 11th all time. You're not. I thought you'd be closer than that. How about Jack Nicklaus?
That's pretty. I mean, okay. Go ahead. Keep going.
No, Jack Nicklaus.
I'll get it.
Brad, Jack Nicklaus career earnings.
Oh, this one's low. $5 million.
There you go. 5.7. He's 283rd all time on the money list with 73 wins. All right, and Justin Thomas, last one.
He's made a lot. I'm going to say 30 million.
That's pretty good, 27.5. He's 25 years old. All right, now, Jay, here are your questions. Okay. The first contract you signed, and for how much was it?
First contract I signed was to play in Italy, and I made $100,000.
Okay, the first golf tournament you ever attended?
The 1983 PGA Championship at Riviera Country Club. I worked as a production assistant for ABC Sports my freshman year in college.
Hal Sutton beat Jack Nicklaus.
Hal Sutton won that, yep.
There you go. All right, the best, worst favorite movie? Like a movie that is that obviously did not win an Academy Award, but to you it's a great movie, but it's really not a great movie.
Notting Hill. I really liked that movie.
Really?
I did. My wife pointed out to me the other night when I was talking about all the gangster films I liked. I just watched Casino, and she said, "You watch way more rom-coms than if everybody knew the author of Toughness watched all the rom-coms you watch." Because I just finished watching Something's Got to Give, too, because I'm a big Nicholson fan. She was giving me a hard time about that.
Well, you actually, you pointed out in your book, I mean, you took piano lessons as a kid. Your mom wanted you to, right?
I took, never piano. She made me take ballroom dancing because she wanted
dancing.
Me to be a cultured individual.
Okay.
Yeah, she made me do a lot of things I didn't want to do.
All right, last question for both of you. Brent, what's your greatest physical feat?
Greatest physical feat. Like, is this like, this is pretty pathetic for me. I don't know. I mean, I've run under a 6-minute mile. That was pretty good for me. For a slow white guy, I did pretty well to do that.
That's not bad. How about you, Jay?
I was, that's the same for me. I ran, we used to run the mile every year, and I ran it 1 year in 5:30, which for a big lumbering dude like me was, I was very proud of that until my roommate, who didn't train at all, ran a 5:11, and Johnny Dawkins ran like a 4:30.
Oh, my gosh.
When that happened, I was like, okay, not all men are created equal. It was not true.
Now, but you were, Jay, you're playing weight, you were 6'8", and what did you play at? Like, when you came back your sophomore year, and you were much bigger.
Well, yeah, my junior year, actually. I started, when I got to Duke, I weighed about 215 pounds when I was a senior. I was about 235, and it was all, you know, kind of upper body. And then after, when I started playing pro ball, I was back down to 225 again. So it was I had to play center in college, so I had to bang up against guys that were way bigger than me, and it was not pleasant, so I had to get a little stronger to deal with it.
Jay, actually, I thought your greatest physical feat, when you carried that TV across your front lawn, you and I had the same television, and you went in and found out what it weighed because you wanted to know what you had just accomplished. I think it weighed 237 pounds. Remember that Sony TV that you picked up and carried?
Yeah, Sony Trinitron that was, was like a wedge, and I had to take it out of the car and get it into the house by myself. Otherwise, it would have gotten stolen out of there because I couldn't shut the back of the car with it in there. And I had to carry that thing a good 250, 300 feet.
What kind of neighborhood were you living in at the time if you were getting it stolen out of the back of your car?
Brent, I don't know. Maybe you're behind the gates neighborhoods now, with patrolmen all the time. But I lived in a nice neighborhood. But if you leave a TV anywhere in the middle of the night, it will be gone the next morning.
Listen.
I think we can try this one out. I think this could be a good test.
Look, both of you guys.
The neighborhood I live in now is a nice one. If I left the TV out in an open car, it'd be gone by the morning. I promise you.
This is a very busy time of the year for both of you. Brant, you've got the Players this week, and obviously the major championship that you take any of them, but I know how personal your relationship with at Augusta National, some of the members there. And Jay, for you, this is what it's all about. You've got all the conference tournaments going on right now, heading into the NCAA tournament, which, by the way, leads right into Masters Week. Thank you to both of you. I really do appreciate you doing this.
No, my pleasure, Gary. We've been friends for forever, really. And Brant, I'm not only a huge admirer of yours personally, but as a pro, love watching you, brother.
Thanks, Jay. It's great to be on. Gary, likewise, can't thank you enough for all you've done for the game of golf. And Jay, big fan. Love hearing you rail on the NCAA on ESPN all the time, and love watching you do games. So have a great I guess season starts tomorrow. Postseason starts what, next week, right?
Yep, next week, and then golf season about 3 weeks after that.
And Brant, he will play more rounds in 4 months than you will play in the next four seasons on the PGA Tour.
I will hit more balls than Vijay Singh, brother. I promise you.
Thanks, guys.
Come out. Come on. We'd love to have you.
Will do. That's a deal.
Hey, is Belmont going to make the tournament? That's my one question.
You know what? They should. That's a good question, Brant. They should, because Dylan Windler is one of the best players in the country, and Rick Bird is one of the best coaches. They should get in over a team like Indiana or somebody like that that has lost half, Texas that has lost half their games. I just don't know the committee's going to do that.
Well, by the way, isn't Rick Bird a really good golfer?
He's a scratch golfer. Really good.
Have you played with him, Brant?
He's a Golf Digest Raider.
Is he really?
Yeah, so he goes and when he's recruiting, and this is next level genius stuff. He goes and gets to play whatever golf course he wants to and rate it. So he's played and he plays everywhere, all over the country.
Jay, is he the best college coach golfer
that I know of? Yeah, there are guys that play, but some of them don't want to admit how good they are, for one, for betting reasons, and the other for on the first tee with their handicaps, and the other is they don't want anybody to think they're playing as much golf as they like to play.
All right, guys, again, thank you so much.
All right,
pleasure.
It is always fun to talk to people who have thoughtful minds, but also can express it. And Brant Snedeker is somebody who I think has a future if he wants to do television. And I also think Brant Snedeker, we talked about the Ryder Cup, I really do believe he would be a really good Ryder Cup captain. And, of course, Jay is what he is. He is an unbelievable mind when it comes to the game of basketball, but it's so much broader than that. And they like to talk, and they like to share ideas, and as you could tell, they just wanted to keep talking. So I thank them, and I thank you for listening to the One Up Podcast with Gary Williams, presented by Peter Millar. Wherever you go, lead a life styled with luxury apparel from Peter Millar.